Morning, everybody. If you woo, I'm hot today, aren't I? About that. 1 Samuel 25 today. Many of you have probably seen the television program, and it is aptly named, but normally the situation is you've got a teenager or a young adult. Sometimes it's even older people, but there is a substance abuse problem. There's some type of problem like that, and family members get together, and to keep this person they love so much from falling deeper into the quagmire of sin and brokenness, they stage what's called an intervention. An intervention. You know, I've watched a few episodes of that, but frankly, I find it pretty painful because if you stay with the program, so often what happens is once people get help, they relapse, and they need another intervention, and another intervention. I thought of that this week, because the truth is, all of us need an intervention. Aren't you thankful for the times that God has put people in your life? And it may have been very painful, but they loved you enough to pull you aside and to say, hey, I'm concerned about the direction things are going here, the direction in which things are going here. I'm concerned about you. Well, that's wonderful, but as we look at 1 Samuel 25 today, I've got something even better than that for you. It is wonderful, if I'm off course, it's wonderful to have someone love me enough to say, Matthew, look, let me help you. You don't need to go down that road. You don't need to take matters into your own hands. You need to hold back. I mean, I'm grateful, and I've had that happen in my life before. But what we're looking at today is an account of how the Lord uses circumstances to hold back his servant David from doing something entirely foolish and that he would regret later. Aren't you glad that all of your plans haven't worked out? Okay? Aren't you glad, and I think most all of us in this room can look back, aren't you glad that at signal and strategic moments in your life and in my life, the Lord has thwarted our plans? Not because he does not love us, but precisely because he knows what is best for us. And he knows we too easily settle for not just second and third and fourth best, but sometimes 25th and 26th best, okay? All right, turn to 1 Samuel 25, and we're going to move quickly today. This is an interesting narrative. The narrator doesn't do a whole lot of narrating in chapter 25. The whole story is carried along by direct discourse, that is, speeches, conversations. And so I want us to look at this story, and I'm calling our lesson today simply Kept Back. Now, as we look in chapter 25, David is going to have interactions with Abigail and her husband. More about him in a moment. You don't get what the writer is after unless you look at the whole of what's going on in 1 Samuel. So go back with me for a minute to 1 Samuel 24. And y'all remember what's going on in 1 Samuel 24? Saul, in his murderous threats, right, is trying to destroy David. And David has ample opportunity, if he had chosen, to, shall we say, do away with, exterminate, be rid of Saul. But you remember the restraint that David shows? He will not touch the Lord's anointed. He will do no harm. It's like David in chapter 24 is saying, look, I know Saul is a madman. I know he's trying to kill me. But that's God's man, and I'm going to leave that with the Lord. So you have this marvelous restraint that he's showing in chapter 24. In chapter 25, things change. We're going to meet the husband of Abigail in just a moment, and he takes some actions which deeply, deeply displease David. But you don't see the David of chapter 24 with restraint. You see him ready to unsheathe the sword and use it And so in chapter 24, David shows restraint. In chapter 25, we're going to see that David, God's man, is restrained from taking matters into his own hands, first by Abigail, and of all people, a servant who is not even named in the text. Don't you love that? An unnamed servant. We don't even know who he is. Yet God uses him and he uses Abigail to keep David back from doing something that would have been disastrous. Okay, so that sets the stage. Now, I call this a case of providential prevention. And you're going to see how the Lord deals with David. He restrains him, but in the restraining of David, he reminds him of his promises. Now, I'm going to argue this morning that every one of us in this room, sooner or later, maybe right now, maybe next week, we need both of those things. There are times in my life when I know I need the Lord to hold me, to keep me back from doing something incredibly stupid. Okay? Psalm 19, verse 13. Remember David's prayer there? Keep your servant back from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. And we're going to see an example of this very thing today. David needed to be restrained, and he needed to be reminded that God would keep all his promises. I think we all need that. So with that in mind, let's jump into this text. Let's look at the purposeful introduction. I'm going to move quickly, so hang on. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. So the author there is just reminding us that there's a transition, there's a shift. Samuel was a huge figure. In one sense, the last of the judges, a prophet of God, the man that God used to stand in the gap as the country was moving from pretty much a tribal confederacy to a theocracy, all right? So the writer records that for us, all right? Then verse 2. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. There was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing sheep in Carmel. Now, don't confuse that Carmel with Mount Carmel, where Elijah took on the prophets of Baal. This is in the deep southern part of Judah. But would you notice with me, we are introduced to a man, and we're told where this man worked, Carmel, what region he was from, Maon. We're told that he was very wealthy, had a lot of property. The only thing we're not told yet is his name. And I think the biblical author does that on purpose. He was shearing sheep in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep. Now, the name of the man was Nabal. How interesting. One author says, with Nabal, possessions precede the person. His life is determined by his property. He is prominent. He is wealthy, yet his very name, which means fool, speaks to the fact that not only was he foolish and short-sighted, but that spiritually, morally, and socially, this guy was a disaster. Okay? That is Nabal. And Nabal is going to be a guy who, to put it bluntly, really unnerves David. And so David will need to be restrained. And at least four times in our text today, verse 26, 33, 34, 39, you read about the Lord restraining. So first we meet Nabal. But look at the contrast. Look at the contrast as we are introduced to his wife. Now, the name of the man, verse 3, was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. So, let me get this straight. Nabal, foolish, harsh, testy. And on the other hand, here's Abigail. Two very good things about her, good sense and good looks. Do you notice that in the text? Now, hang on to that, because we're going to see that played out as we go forward. So there's our introduction. The writer is setting the stage for what's to come. Setting the foundation, and then the superstructure is built on it. Now, in verses 4 through 17, notice with me how there's conflict, and Nabal certainly lives up to his name. Well, let's look at a request that David has, beginning in verse 4. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. Now, if you have sheep to shear and you have as many as Nabal had, you're a wealthy man. So David at this time hears that Nabal is shearing his sheep. Remember, David's not king yet. In fact, in many ways, he's having to run from his life. He has his group of loyal soldiers that are with him. So notice what David is. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him, peace be to you and peace be to your house and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David." Here's what's going on here. David and his men are kind of like unofficial law enforcement guys. Nabal and his shepherds have been out in the field shearing sheep and preparing for that. And basically what David's saying is, hey, I've got some servants. I want y'all to go to Nabal, and you're going to say to Nabal, hey, you've been, it's sheep shearing time, and my men and I have been protecting, serving as guards, so to speak, for your shepherds while they're doing their thing, and we've protected them day and night. We've made sure that things could work out. In fact, David's saying the reason you're having such a good harvest is because we've been standing guard, making sure your guys can do their work. Makes sense, doesn't it? And so David is saying, it's the feast time, it's the harvest time, and you're a rich and wealthy man, and so we're headed your way, and I'm asking, since we took care of you and your guys, show us a little courtesy. You're incredibly wealthy, and throw a spread for us. Okay, that's what's going on here. So David makes this request. Now look what happens in verses 10 and 11. When David's young men, when they came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take," and notice the pronouns here, "my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?" Woo! How do you think that would have gone over with David? We're going to see in just a moment. Well, essentially, Nabal is saying, "Who is this David? For all I know, he's a runaway slave leading a band of marauders through the countryside. Why should I give my food and my meat?" And so he doesn't just reject the request, but he sticks in several well-timed insults. This guy is crabby. It's like he got up on the wrong side of the bed for a month. Well, and that sets the stage for our conflict. Nabal's rejection. Essentially, he's saying, look, as far as I'm concerned, David is a no-count runaway slave, and he and his guys don't need my bread, my water, and my stuff. I'm a wealthy man. I'm trying to enjoy the fruit of my labor. That kind of thing. David's response, look at it. What do you respond? How do you respond when you've been dissed in an ancient way? When you've been disrespected? Well, David's one-word answer to being disrespected was sword. Look at verse 13. Three times, sword. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword. It's go time." I added that go time, but that, okay. And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. Do you see what's going on here? Nobody talks to David that way. Who does this Nabal guy think he is? Nobody disrespects, nobody slanders, nobody mocks, nobody rejects and slams David. And so he's going to take matters in his own hands. He says, hey guys, strap on your swords. We're going to battle. It's go time. So here is the basis of the conflict, but you've got to understand what's going on. Now, notice what God's going to do here. David, remember, he's not the people's choice. He's God's choice, right? He's God's choice. And God is going to protect his servant, and he's going to do it through Abigail, and he's going to do it through this unnamed servant. Now, look at verses 14 through 17, and look how important this servant's testimony is. Verse 14, but one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, and I love this. He's got the perception. He's got the moxie. He's got the courage. He goes to Abigail and he says, hey, Mrs. Nabal's wife, I need to let you in on some stuff that's happened. This is pretty serious stuff. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master. And he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we didn't miss anything when we were in the fields as long as we went with them. So this confirms the fact that David and his men had provided an important service in protecting the shearers of Nabal in the wilderness. They were a wall to us both by day and night, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now, therefore, know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house. Yeah, that's the understatement of the year. The servant is saying to Abigail, look, Nabal really offended David. And David is pretty much headed this way. And if you don't do something, if you don't intervene, there will not be a living male left in the household of your husband. So, just thought I'd let you know, FYI, you know. For harm is determined against our master and against all his house. And then notice, here's another description of Nabal. And he is such a worthless man that one can't speak to him. So, look, the narrator says Nabal's a fool. The servant says Nabal is a fool. And later we're going to see that Abigail's own assessment is that her husband is a fool. He's a moral, spiritual, and social disaster. Man, men in the room, what a reminder to us. Now, Nabal had a lot of wealth. He had a lot of sheep. He was shearing them. He owned a lot of property. But the people who worked for him, people who had interaction with him, even his own wife, thought he was pretty much a fool, clueless. Now, I would just submit to you that there are a lot of Nabals running around today, and the goal for us is not to be a Nabal, okay? Don't be one. Well, let's look at verses 18 through 35. We've got to move quickly. A lot of ground to cover here, but I think we can do it because we've got a lot of direct discourse here. Look at Abigail, her intervention. She speaks with wisdom. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seahs of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. Now, I like this Abigail. I'm telling you, she was a whirlwind of activity. She could get it together. You talk about get together a meal, put on a spread, gather up the covered dishes. She knows what's at stake here. She makes her preparations. This is a resourceful woman. And she said to her young men, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. Now, I realize that in marriage 101, there are not supposed to be any secrets, and we're supposed to tell our wives, and our wives are supposed to be honest with us. But I think the writer records this because she didn't tell Nabal because the guy's clueless. I mean, because of his harsh words, because he railed at David and his men, everybody's about to be wiped out. He's about to get everybody killed, so here we go. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under the cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her, and she met him. Now, look at the next few verses, beginning in verse 21. The way this is set up structurally, you can see it in English. It's also in the Hebrew Old Testament. The next few verses, basically 21 on through 31, the next 11 verses are really the hot spot, the center of this text. It's like the writer is saying, get what's happening here. Don't miss it. Now, David had said, surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he's returned to me evil for good. God so do to the enemies of David, and more also if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him. So Abigail makes preparations, and it's very clear that she needs to do something because David's perspective is one of vengeance. I mean, he's coming to wipe out the house of Nabal, right? Now look at Abigail's plea, verses 23 through 31, the turning point in the story. Notice that she's going to refer to David as Lord, which was a title of respect. She refers to David as Lord some 14 times. Let's look at it. When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, on me alone, Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name. I mean, she's putting it on the line. Look, my husband Nabal has acted like a fool because he is a fool. I love her honesty. And I know you're ready to wipe his whole household out. But I'm pleading with you. And notice her plea. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant. So you see what she's doing? She's intervening. She's standing in the gap for the foolishness of her husband. She's appealing to David. She's the Lord's stop sign put in David's life. David, before you go wipe out all the male servants of my husband, let me just beg you to hold back. Hold back here. Because you see, the Lord, I recognize you're the Lord's chosen servant, and the Lord is going to establish your house, and the Lord is going to sustain your house, and you don't need to do this. You don't need to do something that you're going to regret. You're going to regret it, David. You understand her message? Now, what I find interesting, if you go back to chapter 22, do you remember what Saul did to the priest at Nob? Pretty much had him butchered, didn't he? And so here it is. It's like the Lord is saying, hey, David, you don't need to be deterred by the murderous plans of Saul. Neither do you need to be deterred or thrown off guard or thrown off track by the obnoxious nature of Nabal. Quit trying to take matters in your own hands and leave it with me. Anybody here need to hear that today? Oh, I know. There are plenty of people that are too often too passive. And the fact is, they need to step it up and step up to the plate spiritually. But oh, far too often, we want to do God's work for God. And if we're not careful, we become spiritual control freaks, don't we? Lord, this is what you're going to do, and this is how it's going to work out, and this is how it's got to be, or else I'm not in. Well, here's a story that corrects all of that. Now, look at this. She is aware, and she's God's mouthpiece. The Lord, verse 28, will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. And evil shall not be found in you as long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and he has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. Do you see what's going on here? Abigail is misintervention. Wait a minute, David. God's got great plans for you. God's going to make a clear path for you. Forget your bluster. Forget your off-the-chart testosterone. Back off, David. God's got this. He's got this. And you need to trust him. So that when you get to the place God has designed for you, you don't look back with regretful pangs. That you don't look back and have to remember the pain of unnecessary bloodshed. Wow. Now, notice David's perspective. It changes in verse 32. And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me." Now, David realizes what's happening. "Abigail, I realize you are God's stop sign for me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day." Notice that "kept" again. "You kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me truly by morning, there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male." Then David received from her hand what she'd brought him, and he said to her, "Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I've granted your petition." Wow. Now look at the resolution. And notice that the writer is going to emphasize how God is the source. God's coordinating all of this. God is superintending David's life. He's bringing a servant into Abigail's life who informs Abigail at the strategic time of what's happening. And then the Lord brings Abigail into David's life. And Abigail is this resourceful woman who knows that it all depends on her humanly. And so she basically pours out her heart to David and says, "I beg you, you're the future anointed king of Israel. Don't do this." And the Lord is coordinating all of this. Verse 36. "And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light." So like the fool that he is, Nabal is clueless to what's going on. He's throwing a big party, and he's drunker than Cooter Brown. By the way, I don't know who Cooter Brown is, but they always said that in East Texas. Anyway, the brother's loaded, okay? Not only, and what a picture of his foolishness. Stone cold sober, he's not aware that everything he owns is about a finger snap away from destruction. But not only that, he's partying and he's drunk. Well, the next morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. Most scholars think, basically, Nabal had a stroke. You know, he was just frozen almost. He had a stroke. We'll go on in the text. "And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died." No doubt there, God killed him. God took him out. And I think the writer records that. It's like the message to David is, David, see all the bluster, all your uptightness, strap on the sword, take vengeance, right or wrong, take matters into your own hands, work salvation by your own arm. What's that all about, David? I've got this. You're my man. I'm establishing my kingdom, and it cannot be thwarted. Doesn't mean, David, you're not responsible. Doesn't mean you shouldn't be proactive. You should be all those things. But, oh, David, think about it. Think about it before you do that which you could regret for the rest of your life. Well, look at the rest of the text. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal." And then notice David, here's like the fourth time, he has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. Man, has the Lord ever kept you back from wrongdoing? I've done plenty of wrong in my life, but I can look at you and say, yes, on a number of occasions there have been times when the Lord has used circumstances, people, situations to keep me back from doing something that I would have regretted greatly. And I think what this text is saying is, worship God for that. Thank Him for being the kind of God who knows you and knows me so well that at strategic times in our lives, He throws roadblocks in our plans. He prevents us. Not because He doesn't love us, but precisely because He does. Well, the Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head. Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent to us to you to take you to him as his wife." And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her five young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David, and she became his wife. Well, wish we had the time to talk about polygamy this morning. I know you would love that. We could spend 20 minutes on that. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is that God orchestrated and superintended events in the life of David so that he was kept back from doing regretful things. Now, you're sitting there and you're thinking, well, great, Matthew, that's cool. I'm not David. We're not living 2,000 years ago, plus. But I want to say to you, like I've said before, David's God is the same God. And you and I, through the new covenant, are heirs of salvation. We're a part of a kingdom, and we're kings and priests, 1 Peter 2, right? And so my argument would be that by the resurrection of Jesus Christ and by the power of the Holy Spirit who indwells us, I have no doubt that what God does and did for David, He does for His children today. So if you don't do anything else as a result of this study, I hope you'll take some time today to think through and scroll through your mind, your cerebellum Rolodex, and thank God for the way He's been faithful to protect you when you aren't even sharp enough to figure it out yourself, which is a lot of the time, if you're me. Well, look at the Lord's surplus here. David will not be thrown off by a murderous Saul or an obnoxious Nabal. God restrains and then reinforces with promises. All right, well, let's spend a couple of minutes and we're done. We'll talk about how we can plug this in our lives. Here's your take home today. Because the Lord superintends your steps, He did it for David, He does it for you. And because He sustained you with His promises, the Lord promised David He would be king. Now, the Lord's promises to us are different. He promises us that He'll never leave us or forsake us. He promises us that He'll remove our sins from us as far as the east is from the west. He's given us promises, hasn't He? Right? Because the Lord superintends your steps and sustains you with His promises, worship Him as the one who keeps you back. Lord, thank you for keeping me back. Thank you for rescuing me when I was on the precipice, when I was on the last shard of solid ground before jumping off into disaster. Well, I love what Dale Ralph Davis writes about this text. What loving hands construct the roadblocks to our foolishness? What mercy sends frustration to our purposes? What kindness puts hindrances in our path? I was in Oregon last week preaching and doing a Bible conference at a great church up there. And the guy who was my host was the executive pastor who also works with an addiction recovery group. And he introduced me last Sunday morning to a young man named Matt Massera, who's probably 40 years old. Handsome young man, stood up straight, looks like he's been in the military. And so I met him. And after he walked out of the room, Matt told me this guy's story. Long story short, he came in this city in Oregon. He came up in the roughest of families, drugs. His father was arrested for murder. This young man had attempted to kill as many as 5 people. He was in a gang. He'd been stabbed. I could go on and on. But in this guy's own testimony, he had heard the gospel. He'd been presented with the truth, but he was resisting. He was still caught up in the drug lifestyle. In fact, he was planning to kill a man over a drug deal gone bad. And in fact, he had gone by the man's house to do a dry run because he was going to plan to pull it off later that evening. And he's walking down the street, and he's just thinking as he's walking back to his house about the implications of what he's about to do. Now, he's not even a believer yet. But he's walking, and as he describes it, I was talking to the Lord, and I said, Lord, this is it. If you're real, I need you to show up. I'm at the end of my rope. No sooner had he said those words than he said he heard a voice cry out, Matt. And sure enough, it was the executive pastor who had walked out of a movie store and seen this young man walking up the street. Long and short of it is, God used that timely interception to keep Matt Massera from carrying out his murderous plans. And today, he's a key leader in the addiction recovery group at that church. God's intervention. He can put a person in your path at just the right time. He can control all the tiniest details of your life because he's the divine superintendent. Now, I think we have to also grasp the kingdom connection and the absolutely unique role of Jesus. You see, in the end, what God is saying is, my kingdom is going to be established. I'm going to establish it. And ultimately, it doesn't depend on any human being. David was a great king, but you know he had his failures. God doesn't leave his kingdom to chance. His kingdom is going to be established in his way, in his time, on his terms, and it's established through the one who makes no mistake, the ultimate king on the throne of David. His name is Jesus. Perfect track record. And Jesus, consider him, Hebrews 12:3, who endured the hostility of men, who endured the hostility of the Nabals in his day. That's it. Well, there's a couple of, you know, I love these old hymns, and these are gold. Frederick Faber wrote, there's a wideness in God's mercy like the wideness of the sea. There's a kindness in his justice, which is more than liberty. Aren't you glad there's a wideness in God's mercy? Aren't you glad that he is able, when he so chooses, to intercept you before you jump off the cliff to disaster? And aren't you glad for the times that he's done that? And then I love William Cooper, 1774. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea. He rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable minds of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. I love this verse. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break with blessings on your head. Most of you in this room have lived long enough to know that there are experiences you have that at the time are so obtusely painful that you think, how is God in this? But with reflection and with a little bit of time, you realize that painful experience in my life was a time, a place, an intersection where I met the Lord and I saw His power. And as painful as it was, I wouldn't take anything for it, because I know the Lord is able to keep back His servant from presumptuous sin, to keep back His servant from working His own salvation, to keep back His servant from regret. Aren't you glad of that? Here's the even better news. And you know, the fact is, God can keep me back, but sometimes in my own foolishness, I've gone ahead, plowed on through, and I have a huge, giant mess on aisle 9 that needs to be cleaned up, okay? But even when I've done that, when I say, Lord Jesus, Son of God, who took my place on the cross, who died for me, I've sinned against You, and I confess that. And Your word says You are faithful and righteous to forgive me and to cleanse me. I mean, who is a God like this who pardons my sin when I've blown it? And not only that, He's a God who can hold me back and keep me back. He did it for David, and He'll do it for us. Let's pray. Lord, thanks for today. Thank You for Your word. I pray You'll take these truths and drive them deeper, deeper, and deeper into my life and into the hearts of my friends here. And Father, this week, make us grateful. Make us grateful for Your superintendence. Father, thank You for restraining us and for reinforcing Your promises to us. We thank You. We worship You in Jesus' name. Amen. Y'all have a great week.